corrupted, we've got to purge it. Just like people say, you shouldn't say ain't. It's not right to use gay to mean homosexual. It really, quote, means this. And so they came out with books called Indices of Purged Words. And you know, these are words to be taken away. And then they also had things like, say this, not this. Say, lege kriton ou kryson. The book of Hebrews exhibits that atticistic reaction. And what I would like to say, and I'd be very happy to talk with some of you privately later if you want to, this atticistic reaction business has had a great impact on the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. And there are many people, such as George Kilpatrick, who believe that many of the so-called better readings in the manuscripts are really not to be adopted because they commended themselves to the later scribes. And this, I might say, this reaction picked up steam into the Christian era. So by the 3rd and 4th century, it was going very strongly. You can see it in the writings of Eusebius, for example. So our major manuscripts, like Aleph and B and A and so on, are kind of prey to that atticistic reaction. But you can see that in Hebrews, I think, more than the others. So thanks.
Yes, in the former days of Germans coming over into America, there was concern that if they lost the German language, they would lose their theology. Is there also any evidence of this concern in the writings of the New Testament where they used expressions that were more Hebraic or Aramaic for the sake of preserving what they thought was a theological issue?
All right, now that's an excellent question. And I noted for myself, I thought it's possible nobody will ask any questions, so I better have some extra material here. So I noted for myself something along this line, exactly this concern about the people coming over for the Missouri Synod. Here's what I find really fascinating, is that there didn't seem to be that particular problem, that somehow we're going to lose it if we start going into the language, the lingua franca of the time roundabout. And I think that tells us something. I think that tells us that the salvation is not in the vessel we use, the earthen vessel, may I say, that we use to communicate the gospel, but rather we had better be sure that the ideas that we are conveying through those have not changed. And not to think, for example, we have some guarantee against change simply because we're mouthing the old formulations or something like this. I made reference to it in the paper. I think it is an absolutely astounding thing that the Septuagint ever got on the track. You know, that the people of the Torah actually embraced this in the language of the conquerors, so to speak. But it shows that they did not have this particular thing, and I think we too, you know, have got to look at that. May I say, before we take this question, on the diagram from Wonderly, just to go back to your point here, it seems to me a very important application for us is we had better, when we are communicating in a broad context, such as in the parish, in the classroom, we had better be in the middle crosshatch area here as we speak. You can't gull darn be slumming around with a bunch of stupid stuff and ain't, because then people will not be listening to you. On the other hand, if you are doing all kinds of highfalutin things with vocabulary that the average person can't get, they don't know what you're saying. Preaching, teaching, every kind of communication had better be in the middle part of the diagram.
Pilate made sure that the Jesus, King of the Jews, was placed above the cross in Latin. How prominent was Latin, and did it have any influence on it?
Yeah, now that's an interesting question. They say that at the time of Jesus, Greek was more widely spoken in Rome than was Latin. I couldn't find proof of that, so I didn't put it in the paper. But that's hard to say. Interestingly, Mark, the Gospel of Mark, has some Latinisms in it thus giving the provenance of Rome, such as we would read in Papias and so on like this, and in Irenaeus, who talks about that. But it doesn't seem to have had any particular linguistic influence on Greek, which still was moving forward with a full head of steam as the lingua franca of the time. And in fact, even Latin literary characteristics in terms of letter writings didn't seem to have any impact either.
What class of people was it generally involved? Upper class or middle class?
Was what generally involving?
Latin. Was it spoken by the upper?
I'm not sure entirely on that. I haven't looked into that as much. Certain things in the military were involved with that, in jurisprudence and so forth, but that's something I think for a little further research. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I think this will probably be our last one, but Peter?
Thank you. I was interested in your identification of parataxis as a distinctive characteristic of Hellenism. Would you see any relationship between that and the Hebrew use of the vowel consecutive? Or another way of asking would be, aside from the direct quotations that we find, is it possible to distinguish parataxis from a Jewish first century writer's natural urge to,
right,
to translate that vowel consecutive into Greek?
All right. Now, what you're raising, Peter, is the classic, a classic formulation of the problem. People have said, for example, Schwitzer in his Griechische Grammatik says that the use of chi and de to link in parataxis is normal Greek speech, vernacular Greek speech, from the time of Homer all the way through the classical times. That's why I put that basically in the spoken koine side. As a matter of fact, that probably can be traced even back to the spoken language at the time of 5th century Athens. Now, on the other hand, people who would just as soon see Semitic influence will say exactly what you're suggesting. They'll say, look at here. This corresponds exactly to the vowel consecutive. Here's a classic case of a secondary Semitism. So this is an example of how the secondary Semitism concept is the critical one, and as I said, how frequent is frequent? How many things do you have to find in Greek to show that it was a common way of speaking before a person can say, look, that in fact was just what Greeks did, and just because it happens to resonate here is not really a particularly significant point. But I would say that the chi vowel consecutive one is probably as controverted as any point in this particular thing. Thanks.
Yeah, I can't resist sneaking in a quick comment and a quick question. In the Old Testament department, we call it Semitic enhancement, not interference. And then, on a little different note, I'd be interested in your reaction to the hypothesis that because there aren't any literary antecedents or forms that would suggest the gospel, that perhaps Exodus, with its combination of narrative and teaching, so that a Semitic book was actually, in its larger form, the background for the apostles using the gospel form. Any reaction?
Well, it's a typical Wenthe effort to force this stuff into an Old Testament mode. I know that it's popular to use the enhancement vocabulary. I purposely avoided it. There was an interesting paper presented at the SNTS in 1988 by Charles Talbert, who is probably the best authority on gospel genre in our country, who spoke of the fact that it's very popular to say that the form of the Gospels as we have it, as genre, is not really, or does not find antecedent in the secular writings of the time. He contends that if you look at historical writing or lives of the great men, the bitoi, that basically there are so many what you might call interchangeable components. Like, for example, whether a story starts with a man's infancy or whether it starts with adulthood and so on. There are so many interchangeable components that, as a matter of fact, you can find, you know, the kind of precedence that you need, maybe not with all the individual components put together in precisely the same way, but the idea of focusing on the important individual, having deeds and words which expose who he truly is and his importance for the people and so on, that there actually is a Hellenistic precedent for it. So I will reject that utterly, Wenthe.
Well, I won't respond. It really is quite natural, since you have a first Moses and Jesus was a second Moses.